With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is Internet Marketing.
Hello and welcome to the Internet Marketing Podcast brought to you by Site Visibility. I'm your host, Scott Colnuts, and with me today is Mike Bander, co-founder at Waybook.com, Hopper HQ, and founding partner at Turn Partners. And we're going to be discussing what happens inside a startup studio. And this is a question I asked myself. I saw an email come in from Mike's team discussing their life at Turn Partners and everything that happens at a startup studio. And I thought to myself, well, I don't even know what a startup studio is. I can hazard a guess. I'm pretty certain I'd get it reasonably accurate, but I still want to know what happens behind the scenes. It sounds like an exciting environment. It sounds like something I want to be part of. And it sounds like something that would be an interesting story to share with our listeners. So welcome to the podcast, Mike.
Hello. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
No problem. Do you want to take a moment to introduce yourself to our listeners and feel free to share any personal goals you have in business or marketing or any company mission statements that drive your work at all of those businesses that I've just referenced?
Absolutely, yeah. So great to be here and really talk about something that we don't talk about Turn Partners that much, to be honest with you, because what's interesting is Turn Partners is the kind of parent company, the startup studio, but we're always talking to and with other people about the individual businesses. So it's quite nice to take a step back and figure it out for ourselves. By way of introduction, my name's Mike. I'm one of the co-founders of Turn Partners, as you said, but we are basically the startup studio based out of London, but we're a semi-remote distributed team. We're an entirely bootstrapped group of companies, which adds a really interesting element to everything that we do. I'm based here in London, but we travel quite a lot, obviously pre-COVID, and that's now opening back up. So we have team split all across the UK, Ireland, Philippines, Russia, India, Latvia, all sorts of LATAM. And essentially, in terms of goals, in terms of what I want to do, is my personal goal is I want to have a positive impact to more people in more places than I'd ever be able to go. And really, I believe that entrepreneurship and enterprise is the way for that. You know, some people are great artists, some people are great mathematicians and builders, and I was blessed to be useless at everything apart from kind of what I consider as the logic of entrepreneurship. So that's kind of my personal driving force, and really that runs through into what we aim to do within Turn Partners. We're fundamentally about creating digital businesses that are essentially enabling people to do their business better. So we're largely focused on digital B2B solutions that help people find efficiency in their work. We focus a lot on the future of work and basically making sure that people can unlock and empower themselves, their communities, and everything around through entrepreneurship and through their businesses.
Help as many people in as many places as possible is a really interesting thought, because in marketing and just when you work on in any online related business, maybe you have like these moments maybe once or twice a year where you're like, thank God for the internet, thank God that I get to kind of work from anywhere. And I was just really thinking about the reach there as you were talking. And I'd just taken a moment to really appreciate the reach of the work, because, you know, how lucky are we to be alive in an age where we can apply our skills? Do you ever wonder to yourself, what would you be doing if there wasn't the internet and you didn't have the ability to reach that many people? What would your goals be?
I couldn't even imagine. My carbon footprint would probably be more, that's for sure. So my thing is have a positive impact on more people in more places, and that's super, super varied and super broad. But actually, you're absolutely right. I think technology in general and the internet enables us to have such a big, you know, kind of ripple effect on everything we do. Obviously, marketing is just is the most obvious version of that, because we can just in an instant get to millions of people. But there is a fundamental difference between marketing and actually the value you can create to people, and we do that for our businesses in all different sorts of ways. But yeah, you're totally right. We're so blessed to be in that to be in that wide reaching and kind of fast changing environment as well. I mean, I don't know how old you are, Scott, but I remember like taking out my first Hotmail account on a dial-up connection, and that was novel and wild at the time, and I was like, wow, what is, you know, this is going to be an exciting thing. And then it's changed every day. So
that's the gratitude journal tick for today.
That's it. I'm writing on that line.
And so on my, as I was talking in the intro there, I asked myself, what is a startup studio? Could you maybe just talk through your definition? Is there a widely accepted definition of what a startup studio is? What is it to you?
Yeah, I mean, as you were asking that question, I thought, yeah, what is a startup studio? And then I'm instantly thinking, I'm sure my definition of it will be wildly different to other people. So I can just tell you what ours is.
Sure.
Firstly, we didn't look up a startup studio in a business book and say, let's do that business. We sort of made it up, and I'm not saying we created it, because I know there's loads of other people that do the similar thing and call it similar things. But startup studio, you said that you can pretty much figure out what it is, and that's basically we called it what we thought it was. It's pretty much fundamentally it's me and my business partner James and our kind of core group of team that are, some people are generalists, some people are kind of really specific, like experts in what they do. And we largely just focus on creating value. We largely just focus on creating scalable, high impact businesses that actually we can execute on. So we within the startup studio will either acquire or build digital businesses. On the acquisition front, we largely ask ourselves the question of, what can we do better than the founding team? And does that fit with our resources and our interests and our direction of travel? Does it work well with the other companies we're working with at the time? And then on the kind of creation side, we really look at where do we see the world going? What problems do we want to solve? How can we have an impact? And then also we do pair that with what can we really do exceptionally well with our knowledge, our skills, our resources, knowing that we're always going to be growing and developing, but actually what can we do really well? So essentially a startup studio is just almost like a labs department that you see in some corporates. It's a venture builder in some other businesses. Although when we first started talking about this kind of seven years ago, or 8 years ago now, a lot of people were like, oh, so like private equity then. And, and we sort of just went with that for a little bit of time, but really it's not. It's really not. I think the acquisition side makes it look and feel a bit like, let's call it nano private equity. It's not even, you know, private equity, but also, I think if we're fully honest, James and I really just wanted to do great stuff, and we didn't know what the best the best vehicle was for that. So it became a startup studio, and then that sort of like develops and changes and maintains focus as we go.
And for the benefit of the listeners, who's James?
Sorry, James Vardy is my co-founder in Talent Partners and across all of the businesses as well.
And we'll get to breaking down the team a little bit more in a moment, but. Sure. Yeah, it's interesting as you describe the startup studio environment there, because it feels very modern to me. And I think the interesting component about what you do is both the acquisition and the build side. And I think that's maybe what throws people is that it's, I remember reading somewhere in my notes, or maybe it was on your website, about like a lean startup approach to what you do. And so it speaks to that, and it speaks to the iterative improvement approach of what it's like to be in product management. So there's loads I'm going to break down there in a moment, but I think it's just an interesting component that you both acquire and build businesses. And actually maybe just telling that story from the beginning for me. So you mentioned your business partner there, James. Have you worked with him from the start? Tell me the story from the beginning. When did you decide to build Turn Partners as the parent company? And maybe the timeline of when some of these key businesses started to become part of Turn Partners.
Yeah, sure. So James and I had both previously run businesses before. We actually met in 2011 on a learning and development program called the New Entrepreneurs Foundation. It's now called Center for Entrepreneurs. And really, this was like a 12-month training program for entrepreneurs. There was 25 people on the program. And it was absolutely phenomenal experience. We all had a placement in a fast growth business. So I was in had a new business for a scaling ad agency. James was at Seatwave. But then you also get really fantastic training with, you know, negotiation by the people that train all of the European kind of members of parliament, and, you know, resilience training from Tesco's and finance training from Deloitte and all sorts. And you also get exposure to just really incredible business leaders. And really, this program, we were so incredibly lucky to be a part of this cohort and community that really is just interested in unpicking business ideas and figuring stuff out. And what that did for me personally is actually enabled me to think much bigger. I think previously I'd run a paintball company. I'd run, a few different... I was a bit of a Dell boy, so I'd buy and sell different bits and do all sorts. And actually, that was sort of what business was to me at that time. But the New Entrepreneurs Foundation enabled me to have that from a global perspective and really, really kind of widen out my ambition. Going through that experience together with James, we both sort of just started working on ideas, and we were drawn to each other because we were fundamentally aligned from an ethos perspective. Mm-hmm. So we are morally and ethically very aligned, but also we wanted to run the business for the same reason. We wanted to actually build a phenomenal culture. We wanted to build products that we had pride in. And, you know, the most exciting thing that happens to us is when we see and hear our products being talked about when we've not put them. You know, we've not told people, oh, you know, we run Hopper, we run Waybook, and people are like, oh, I know them. It's more like, oh, I use this great tool, and it's waybook.com. And we're that, you know, that is, for us, that's fuel. That's why we do this. So actually, this experience meant that James and I almost started by playing with different business ideas. And we decided that we would sort of start a business together. We were working on a few different things. And then the opportunity to buy a business came up, and that was our dating business. And it was at that point where James and I had realized we'd both started a business, and what we were really interested in is, you know, that next step, that next going from, you know, a team of five to a team of 25, you know, and that was the thing we hadn't done at the time. So yeah, we acquired this dating site. And that was our initial turnaround. But because we didn't want to be in dating all the time, it was quite an opportunity-led thing and what we were interested in at the point. We then said, you know, instead of buying the dating business and running the dating business, why don't we put this within a structure that is then enables us to think wider and think, you know, not transactional from the dating business perspective, but enable us to really be the founding step for us in terms of building something bigger and building something greater. So we acquired the dating business, and then I'm sure we'll go into the specifics of how we then got to the point where our dating business was great. Like we were growing. We'd really done a good job of rebranding this. We'd rebuilt the product. It was pretty well known within the space. And actually, we we wanted a little bit more, because actually, even though dating fundamentally is quite an amazing product and service to run, you know, the product is basic, but what you're giving people is that connection and those experiences. We always had more focus on this B2B and future of work. So we then realized that because we're pretty process driven, everything was processed, everything was delegated, we were able to grow at pretty much the same rate outside of the business as the business could grow with us in. You know, we'd take a couple of percentage points a month growth away without our time, but we were then excited that we then had 100% of our time and resource to then look for the next thing, and that's where we came onto Hopper HQ, which was our next business.
Okay, I'd love to break down some of that early part of the story then. So I'm thinking back, what year are we talking when you acquired the dating business then? 2012-ish?
That was 2013.
And at that point, you've mentioned in the intro there that you've got some entrepreneurial experience, as has James. The first question that comes to mind for me is, why dating? That seems like an incredibly difficult world to get into. Just curious about what that's just an interesting place to start.
I speak to quite a lot of people that are like, so I'm thinking of starting a dating site, and my first thing is, please don't.
Yeah.
For you, don't do it. It was opportunity led, Scott. We were actually launching a fitness supplement company by subscription. And this was when Gray's Box and, you know, Love Film and everything was becoming huge, and we loved the subscription model, we loved the product. So we were doing protein supplements by subscription. It wasn't quite working. Mm. And then I was also doing a bit of consulting on the side, and I met somebody who asked me to do some consultancy for them, producing a commercial model for a new business. Yeah. And I found out that actually she owned this dating site that she'd sort of just fallen out of love with.
Right.
And as soon as I left that first conversation, I called James and I was like, do you want to go into dating? I think there's something exciting here. So it was purely opportunity led. And one thing that we're very excited about that don't often hear being discussed in entrepreneurship is something called effectual thinking. And this essentially is the process of early stage idea generation and decision making, where you look at what you have and who you are and what you know, and you kind of you then move to the next logical step, as well as heading in a direction that you want to head in, rather than saying, okay, we want to start. Okay, let me wind back. Waybook.com is basically our dream business, right? It has absolutely everything for us. We love it. We do. It's just amazing. But I don't think that we would have been able to have started Waybook and got it to where it is today if we'd have started it back into 2013.
Mm.
But I do think that our conviction and ability to execute on turning around our dating business back in 2013 was, for us, maybe ignorantly, it was almost a certainty for us. We could look at it. We knew what design things to change. We knew how to manage the marketing. We knew how to do bits that we had already executed on. So it was a bit of a no-brainer for us to take that small leap and put us in an entirely different situation that then meant we were able to see other opportunities to go to the next thing and the next thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like this concept of effectual thinking, where you start from who you are, what you know, who you know, and you allow these goals and opportunities to emerge over time, is a way of entrepreneurship that actually falls entirely out of what we see on Dragon's Den and The Apprentice, and here when people like raise £10 billion and all of this sort mm-hmm. of stuff. It's very much akin to the bootstrap mindset, but it actually gives you so much more control in terms of what you do. And it also means that you then don't have to become a product of the first business you start. It means that you just start and then you allow those goals and opportunities to emerge over time. Now, that may be within one business, but for us, it ended up in multiple businesses. And that's what Term Partners as a structure facilitated.
Mm. Yeah, it strikes me as very fluid. And as I said, it speaks to the lean startup mindset of being very iterative as well. So I understand that part. A part that I'm trying to piece together, though, is so I've understood then the attractiveness of maybe launching or acquiring a dating site. And interestingly, as I think this through, I assume the business model of a dating site or that dating site was similar to what a software as a service company is, in that people may pay for advanced profiles or something like that, or a premium membership.
Exactly that.
So I'm assuming that's what attracted you to that kind of business model as well. That's kind of SaaS mindset.
Absolutely. And so, I mean, one of the things that really attracted us to it is the dating business had a real fundamental, a good following, a good set of users. It was profitable, but they didn't do recurring billing.
Yeah.
And it was basically one of the only dating businesses that didn't have recurring billing. So for us, that was, doing that actual billing change, essentially, that we could do on day one, just turn the business around. So, we grew that business by 1,800% in about 2 years. And we've done a lot of clever and smart things, but I must admit the thing that really kickstarted it was actually just turning on recurring billing, adjusting pricing, adding a bit more value in, putting a bit more focus onto what people get from the business and what value they actually want. And then that really set us on the course to make the other changes.
That's really interesting. So I've understood there how you've applied your entrepreneurial skills to turn that business around, make money, grow the business. But the missing piece for me then is the technical aspect of this. So going into that dating business, had you or James had any technical experience in building, managing, developing websites or software? Because I imagine that's important, or is that the part that you delegated?
It's absolutely important. And I know a lot of amazing founders that haven't got started because they don't know tech, or they don't have a tech co-founder. And, most investors, probably rightly so, won't invest in a team unless there's a co-founder, technical co-founder. But no, we didn't. We're like, James and I weren't developers. James is definitely more technical than I am. So he's, he's a product manager by trade, and he's, he can understand technology to run a good dev team, and he is a designer, so he understands the fundamentals of how a product should be and how it could work. Mm-hmm. But in terms of actually doing that work, that was all outsourced.
And
or hired.
Yeah, and that can be a really difficult thing. Again, I've spoken to entrepreneurs on the podcast and just colleagues and peers in the past about that process, that you can be a great marketer, you can have that entrepreneurial spirit or experience, but to then bring it to life and brief in a consultant or outsource the actual build can be that big challenge that gets in the way of people taking that next step. Was it a nervy time for you, or is there anything from that? I've forgotten the name of the kind of course or scheme that you talked about back in 2011, but was there anything that you learned from there that helped you in really taking the leap and outsourcing that work?
Yeah, what we learned in that course was just that things are doable and you're never far from being able to figure out how to do stuff you don't know. Mm-hmm. I've really simplified it. There was loads of really great specific stuff on there as well, of course. But also, I think one thing that, and I must just take myself out of this, Scott. I'm not being an easy guest to interview here, because I know I'm being quite high level and ambiguous. So I really like your challenges of getting more specific to stuff. One thing that underpins absolutely everything across what we do is we remove ambiguity from everything where ambiguity can be removed. Mm. And we are very process driven, and we're very structured in our thinking. And we basically focus on how we can free up as much of our headset as possible in order to work out the highly ambiguous, difficult, challenging unknowns. And as soon as we figure out how something can work or should work, it's documented, it's systematized, it's delegated, it goes into a process. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that the first thing that we discover is the best way of doing something. So that whether that be a technical thing, or whether that be actually how we execute on an ads campaign or whatever. But it does mean that we've done that thinking once, we've documented it, and that can then be easily replicated and repeated and picked up by somebody else that's not our headset. And repeated again and again and again, And then our head is entirely free to then think about either the next challenge and the next problem, or of course, the next iteration of that problem. And the reason why we run, or we started waybook.com, is because it is that absolute, it's that absolute focus on figuring stuff out and then getting your business out of your brain, documenting, systematizing, getting that into a structure that is easily disseminated between your team, that you know, can kind of keep all of your team members up to date and on the same page, so they can execute on the way things are done, rather constantly spending that time figuring out how things should be done. That for us is the secret sauce as to why we've been able to move quickly between different things and have the confidence, even at the early stage, to you know, have the trust and move forward, removing ambiguity.
Getting your business out of your brain. That's perfect dad copy, by the way. That's yeah.
So, coming soon to an app near you.
I mean, really, as we talk through this podcast, I'm sure it's going to culminate in kind of the ultimately we're going to end up on the story of how waybook.com was born. I can see how that's happening, but and how that happened. Going back to the dating site and the early growth of that, so I've kind of got a good understanding now of the idea, what you were executing, how you were delegating. How long was it before really you got a team involved in running that, so that you and James were hands off maybe to focus a little bit more on the next thing? Can you remember?
Yeah, so I think we had a period of about 6 months, which was a big chunk of our actual turnaround time, where we didn't do a huge amount.
Yeah.
One thing that we were really careful to remind ourselves of is that we weren't our customers, and we hadn't used our service. And yes, we can look at the analytics, but there was a lot of nuances in how our brand was and how people enjoyed it. And, you know, so actually we made slow, methodical changes as we really got close to our customers. And the other reality within that is we were also then saving up a bit of money so we could spend it, and we needed confidence in the changes we make. You've got to remember at the time, I think we were kind of 23, and mm-hmm. and we basically poured all of our money into buying this business. Mm-hmm. So we didn't really have any more to put into it, and we didn't want to take investment. So the steps we were taking, we had to have relative high conviction. So yeah, we basically took the time and we did these kind of like slower changes, and really we built the business out on initially quite early, quite junior staff that were fresh out of university. Mm. And they probably first came in, and answer to your question, they probably first came in about 6 months after we'd first started the business, and that's when we started to execute on marketing channels. Yeah. And they came in as almost like generalist marketing staff, to kind of, you know, run through the processes that we had figured out that did work, and mm-hmm. and enable us to then work with them, but also work with other people to find out better best practice and how we could create new things. So about 6 months in, and then we probably added more processes than we did people, but actually adding those processes enabled us to then grow faster without exponentially increasing our headcount.
That makes sense. And did those staff become part of Term Partners, or were they dedicated just to the dating site?
Well, yeah, I mean, interestingly, at the time, Term Partners was the dating site, right? So we had Term Partners was almost a concept. So everybody right. that came in, they knew that, you know, that was the vision. They knew they were part of something.
Right.
And I think our second hire, Matt, he is now the business manager for the dating business. And he also has been fundamental to the marketing foundations of Hopper, and also has supported on Waybook. So yeah, he was very much in from day one, and has been like an amazing part of the team ever since then.
Wonderful. And so you've just mentioned Hopper there, and that's the next kind of, for me, the next natural step in the story is how did the idea for Hopper come about? Where in this journey did the idea come up? How did you start to work on it? Was that a build or an acquisition? Talk me through that.
Sure. So I mean, I sort of mentioned earlier, but we were at a point probably about 18 months in. We were growing at around 15% a month. And we sort of realized that there's a natural limit to where we could have taken the dating business. Or more specifically, there became a point where we ended up getting less return for the investment going in. We're a niche dating business, so it's very difficult to market size. And at the time, a lot of marketing channels had actually become very difficult to execute on, because dating as an industry is highly fragmented, but actually is underpinned by lots of like networked sites, if you like. So you'll see thousands of dating sites with thousands of different brands, which are actually all exactly the same site underneath. Mm-hmm. Which actually meant if you worked with any publication, so like FHM at the time, for example, they would have been a great placement for our dating business. But instead of that, they would just start FHM dating, because there was no, you know, they just needed to do user acquisition. Mm-hmm. So it became increasingly difficult to grow or to find new growth from the business. And James and I basically realized that we can still continue to grow the business at around, we reckoned about 12% growth rather than 15% growth without our time. So we then started to put more systems in place. We started to replace ourselves even more, and start to actually almost, we got to the point where we're like, the value of our time and also the fulfillment of our time, like where we want to be spending our time, is perhaps better elsewhere. Now, because we always had the term partners head on, we always did fun things as a team. So we would spend, you know, an afternoon every now and then doing an idea session and a hack day. And we'd always build little products and prototypes and things like that, just testing stuff out. And one weekend, James and I were just playing around. And at this point, Instagram was becoming huge. And we thought, look, this is just, you know, it just overtaken Twitter.
What year are we talking now?
So this is 2014.
Yeah.
And we were like, there's got to be some stuff in here. So we then thought, let's just look at the space. One of my cousins and a few of our friends had quite big Instagram accounts at the time. And we thought, wouldn't it be good? This was pre-monetization. If we could help people monetize their following. So the original idea was actually an app that could enable you to follow someone in a way that gives you more advanced or early access content. So think of a personal trainer that uses it for lead gen, but then also they have another account, which is a private account that you can pay a subscription for. And, you know, you get like full workout sessions or things like that. So that was the original thing. So we kind of mocked together this little idea, and we put it in front of lots of initially people we knew and then lots of people we didn't. And they were like, yeah, that's kind of cool, but it didn't really stick. But they said, but what is difficult is it's difficult to actually manage our Instagram account. Like, it's difficult to actually choose what to post and when to post it and get it on, like transfer it to my phone and get it up on the platform and stuff like that. And, you know, scheduling for social media had been a pretty big thing, but no one had really nailed it for Instagram, because these were lots of platforms like Hootsuite and the people that many of us know, that they were built for Twitter. So they're text-based, and they had some, you know, they hadn't really worked out how to go to the next level of, you know, image and video first. So we kind of just said, all right, let's build a scheduling tool for Instagram. So we mocked some stuff together. And again, because we're lean and iterative, James built me some designs on a PowerPoint. And I just went around some agencies in London and was like, so this is Hopper. You click here, but don't click here because it's not real. You do this, you upload posts here, this is what you do. And it was like a classic like lean iterative story. Agency one would say no, and I'd ask why, and they'd say, you know, because actually this isn't the challenge for us. We need a way of managing our team. Okay, fine. Agency two would say, yeah, that could be good, you know, but we really want this, or we don't need that. And then we started fine tuning. And every meeting, James would just add something new or remove something from the design.
Right.
And we started getting to the point where people were like, yeah, this is good. Let's do it. And actually, the first agency we closed was the agency that ran the social media accounts for Peaky Blinders. And at the time, I was like a massive Peaky Blinders fan. So I thought Tommy Shelby just truly had our back in that meeting. So, you know, they said, yeah, let's do it. We'll have 10 accounts. And I said, cool, just give me 6 months. I'll get right back to you. So yeah, we'd already started seeing very good signs. So we'd started building out some fundamentals and we built that product, continued to then like build our foundational marketing. And we launched it. We went to market, and Hopper was just a utility to upload, plan, and therefore schedule your Instagram posts. And obviously it's changed a huge amount since then when we first launched in 2015.
Yeah, I remember in 2015 around that time that was the major problem with Instagram. It's funny as you were talking as well, because the original idea for Hopper that you just discussed, it, even though it didn't turn into what you expected it to, a lot of what you said about exclusivity and membership related content is the world we see today.
You have
YouTube, you know, I forget what it's called, like YouTube memberships and Patreon, all of those different things. And it's like every single, even Twitch, you know, all of these platforms have membership exclusive features. So actually the idea back then was ahead of its time, and, you know, you could see what the future was going to become.
It's definitely interesting. And actually one thing I, because if you think about these content creators as like micro businesses and entrepreneurs, like we like the idea of actually enabling people to you know, build a business and therefore fund their passions and interests about creating content that's genuinely interesting, so they can invest more into it. And then obviously, yeah, like the influencer space has exploded. It's all exploded. But I think just you could see it and feel it there at the platform, that actually there were so many amazing people, content creators, that were doing this as passion projects. It almost needed to become something in order for that level of creativity to continue.
With Hopper, similar questions as to those that I asked before. So I've understood it correctly, the actual MVP of the product wasn't built as you were pitching it. You built it after you started to get the idea validated from agencies. Is that correct?
Yeah, and even more so than that, it's not. Yeah, the validation wasn't, yeah, we might buy this. It was we will have 8 accounts or whatever. And so yeah, absolutely. And that is the best practice here, right? Well, from our perspective, particularly as a bootstrap startup, because at that time we're saying, cool, Hopper's our dating business is profitable, it's growing, but for us to take £1 from the dating business, we need to have as much conviction or near enough conviction that can go to some value than what we can get back from it in growing the dating business. So it was actually that level of discipline. And I do truly believe that it's because we've remained bootstrapped that we've been able to stay closer to having the real value-based conversations. I think you see some amazing businesses that almost lose their focus on providing value to customers because they just actually have too much cash to spend and they can go wide. And of course, quite often that ends up in building amazing things that would never work from the bootstrap lean perspective. But for us, like that just wasn't the way at the time.
Yeah, interesting. And where was I in my, I was kind of piecing together the journey for myself. And did you outsource the build of the product again for Hopper as you did previously with the dating agency side?
Interestingly, yeah. So we did have developers then at that point, because obviously of the dating business. We actually originally did outsource the initial MVP. And we did that because we still had a very small tech team and we didn't want Hopper to be a total distraction to the dating business. So we outsourced the initial MVP, but those outsourced people then became our team. So one of our colleagues, Stan, he's been involved since day one. So he's been, you know, doing Hopper since then. And also Dan was very, very early on in 2015, and he was originally as a contractor, and now he's like chief technologist with us. So So it was external, but it was a mix. It wasn't necessarily agency. It was, some contracts, some freelance, and then they've rolled in.
Yeah. And at what point, because you talked there about it originally being a product, maybe exclusively for agencies, but I assume there was a pivotal point in which you opened that up as a SaaS product. Can you remember how far into the journey that was?
Well, yeah. So even though it's for agencies, it was always going to be SaaS. So, right. So the model was always software as a service. But it was actually easier for us to get the validation from agencies, just because I could easily get the meetings to walk into an agency in London, and it was a target market that we could kind of see and do, you know. And actually, I felt like, because I think it's harder to sell to an agency than it is to a tiny business, that in order for us to have more conviction, if an agency would agree and get it over the line, then perhaps a smaller business would be good. And the other thing, one thing we knew, that actually if we provided more value to bigger businesses, then our ticket price could be higher. And obviously that means we could move faster. So it was originally always going to be SaaS. Originally we were talking to agencies, but honestly, it just sort of exploded. I think it was so poignant at the time that people really wanted scheduling for Instagram, that it didn't matter if you were an agency or not. If you found out about Hopper, you'd probably give it a go. So it quickly became, our focused marketing quickly became unfocused marketing by demand. And as many marketers listening here, that's sort of sounds great, but also has a whole world of its own problems as well. Because without that focus, it's difficult to really go deeper and really get the numbers that make a massive impact.
Mm. And are Hopper and is the dating website, is that still under the Turn Partners umbrella, full ownership today within Turn Partners?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So it's all 100% owned. We actually, interestingly, we had an offer to acquire our dating business years ago now, and that was always the original plan. We were going to buy and turn around businesses, and then we had an offer, and it was a very good offer. It would have been a life changing deal. But it just wasn't, it didn't meet our expectations at the time. So we kind of just said, no, it doesn't meet our expectations at the time. We weren't too fussed about selling. And then actually the M&A market, the merger and acquisition market in dating, just totally dive bombed after that. Just because it, you know, the space changed and the consolidation changed. So actually, for a few years, I did secretly have in the back of my head, damn, we could have sold the business then. But obviously, when you're selling a business, it's largely done, a profitable business, largely done on as a multiple of EBITDA, of your profit. And we were looking at about four and a half times EBITDA. So fast forward 4 years after we turned down that acquisition deal, we had then made the same amount of money as we would have done if we'd have sold the business, and we still own the business. And it's amazing, Scott, how quickly your internal narrative can go from, oh yeah, maybe we should have sold, to, I am a strategic genius. Yeah. Of course we would have never have sold 4 years ago. So yeah, the hindsight of that has been fantastic. But also that's been a good lesson for us in terms of, as long as we still love the businesses that we're running, as long as the teams are still working, I'm not going to lie, that the splitting of headspace between the businesses does have challenges. But again, having that focus on systems, on processes, and having the right people in the right places has enabled us to kind of hold it together up until now, at least. And we'll see we'll see how it continues to scale.
Well, systems and processes leads us nicely to wagbook.com, the kind of final piece of this puzzle in this kind of story so far, at least. There's a lot, I'm sure, in between that we'll talk about. But just take me through then Wagbook. So very similarly, when did that start to come up as an idea? And what was the process in getting that product off the ground?
Sure, yeah. So I think by now we had a distributed team. We had a semi-remote structure, so a couple of offices, but most people kind of in and around different locations. We had functions that worked between the businesses. So we have one head of customer success that works between a couple of the businesses. But then, you know, we had different customer success execs in the businesses. We had like an interesting structure that was sort of held together by a series of docs and a series of, you know, systems and all sorts. And there was a point where James and I were very happy with that structure. But as we continued to grow and we continued to scale, we sort of realized that every time you add about, I don't know, two or three people, everything sort of falls over, right? Everything sorts of, the way you communicate, what you do, how you like transact, everything sort of needs to change. And even though the individual processes stay the same, just simple things like giving the right person access to the right document or making sure that they've like read it and understood it and can internalize it and can execute it, particularly when you're on different time zones or particularly when you're not face to face. And then also we started to feel these slight growing pains of we perhaps, you know, weren't certain that we gave everyone the right level of context from like a knowledge or an understanding in order to truly be firstly brought into the culture and aligned to the culture and contributing to the culture, but secondly, really understanding what they do and how that matters to you know, everything we do from either a very specific execution point of view or from a more generalized, I'm part of this business point of view. And we started to realize that even though we were quite proud of our series of Google Docs and various different systems that stitched together, that there was holes there. And there was one point for me where I'd had a conversation with one of our marketing team that I hadn't actually spent a huge amount of time with. They were a couple of months in and they were working with someone else. And they were just explaining to me what they were doing. We were just having a general chat. And I realized that my level of understanding of what I thought was happening and actually what was happening as that additional layer went in was so fundamentally flawed. It's like the gap between expectation and reality. It just wasn't as aligned as what I thought it was. And actually that's because, you know, the knowledge had changed since we'd done these original docs, and the people had picked up and done slight different adjustments, and some people had left and their docs had got disappeared into their Google Drive accounts or their Dropbox and things like that. And we thought, damn, there has to be a better way to bring all of this together. And also we'd heard that a lot of people's time had just, and we'd felt it as well, just been totally consumed by the same questions. Little things like, where are the logo files? Which is fine to ask, but actually when there's five people asking the same person that multiple times, that can be half an hour of your time sending logo files links, you know? So we sort of had an inkling that we needed to be better, even though everything we'd done, like the concept of documenting, had actually got us so far. We felt like there wasn't a system around it in order for us to really, really scale this business and really truly believe that the dating business can work whilst we're working on something else. And actually the marketing team within Hopper can work whilst we're looking at something else, even within that business. So that was basically the seed for Waybook. And we started looking in the space and fortunately got some amazing friends that run some really phenomenal businesses. And it's something we heard time and time again. Not everyone had been so kind of strict with their documentation. So they just wanted to get, you know, document their business so they could pass it on to other people. Not everybody had, you know, the ability to look at the levels of docs that they had so they can iterate the process and then free up their mind to work on the business. So we knew that the problem was validated at least. So then we just went through similar sort of situations as we did with Hopper, and we started just sketching out, okay, so what do you need in order to really be able to, you know, be comfortable and excited growing your business? And then also to their teams, we asked the question, what do you need in order to be excellent at your job? Managers would say they needed consistency of communication, and new joiners would say they just needed, you know, kind of access and support at all times. So Waybook is essentially it essentially grew up to be this seemingly simple yet phenomenally powerful product that enables, you know, whether that be founders or senior leaders or anyone within your organization to just document all of your systems, your knowledge and your processes in a way that doesn't feel like you're documenting your knowledge, systems and processes, because it sounds boring, right? But in a way that actually it's quite a therapeutic process, saying, okay, here are the five things we need to do. I remember documenting my first process to onboard somebody in Waybook when it was built as a product. And I was laughing like a maniac because I'm thinking, I am never going to have to repeat this like this answer again. Like, this knowledge is here for everybody now and everyone's going to have access. So it enables teams to document their knowledge, systems and processes. But crucially, that then becomes really high impacting onboarding and training material. So you get a new joiner within your business, you add them to your Waybook, and instantly they have access to all of the content you want them to have. And they can just work through that content as an onboarding process. They can get the company background. They can see the videos from you. They can search for the logo files if they need the logo files. You know, all of these things that actually took up a lot of time and had a lot of inconsistency as you grow in your team. It's out of the box. It's in front of your team. So yeah, we built an early version of it and some of our kind of friends. And then also, obviously, we can put this in front of Hopper customers. So other customers jumped on and yeah, I mean, just the feedback we were getting from it was just absolutely phenomenal. So it enabled us to really, really go double down on the product. And I must say, this is where perhaps as a group, we've become slightly less lean, because we invested very, very heavily in the product because we had so much conviction on the problem from our own experiences, but also the use cases from our early adopters.
So thinking all that through, so how long's Waybook.com been in operation now?
Waybook's kind of been around for about 2 years now. I mean, because really it was born out and like the very, very early version has been about 2 years, but really the version that's been in front of people and people have been signing up and all sorts is probably about 14 months, about a year and a half.
And right at the beginning of the podcast, you had noted that you have a semi-remote team based all around the world. So as we talk today, under that Tern Partners umbrella, how many workers have you got working across these various projects?
Yeah, so this is one of the amazing things. So our team is still pretty tiny and pretty small. So we're 27 full time, but we have a lot of people that work on very specific things in very specific areas. And we sort of pride ourselves on the fact that we're able to kind of keep lean and keep focused on what we do. And that is because of the process, you know, that is because of the automation where possible and continue to focus on value. So yeah, in terms of full-time employed, we're 27 at the moment, but then we also have, customer service execs and people that run events for us and lots of different bits that aren't included in that core. The term partners crew, if you like, is much wider, but the initial is 27.
And I'm interested to know the skills and characteristics of the members of your team, or just your advice in general to people that are interested in building their own startup studio, or perhaps the people that are thinking about applying for a role at a startup studio, something that you've described today. What are the skills and characteristics that you think are required to really succeed in that type of environment?
Yeah, I think there's this curiosity that's really, really important to not necessarily solve the problem that's in front of you, but it's more to understand that in every single interaction, there could be multiple problems, multiple solutions, but also multiple connections to things that already exist. And I think really the skills or the structure that I think works really well for a startup studio is actually a mix of skills. I am definitely one of the few people that works across all the businesses. And actually that only works because there's other people that work exclusively in the other businesses. So from a startup studio perspective, if you're in the kind of core centralized team, then I think that curiosity and real, you know, real thirst for building, if you like, it has to be there. But also, I think that also comes with the humility that actually you don't always know the best way to do things, and having the ability to accept where other people can either do it better or more efficiently than you, and knowing when to, you know, how far to push something before it actually becomes significantly better in someone else's hands. Mm. And then I think the challenge that you face within this is you're constantly fighting the balance. From an individual perspective, you're constantly fighting the balance of breadth versus depth. And, you know, on today, for example, straight after this, I'm speaking with our business manager at the dating business. And I've also been on interviews we have loads of roles open at the moment. So I'm on interviews for both Hopper and also Waybook. And actually that breadth is comes at the cost of depth on some of the stuff. So I feel like you just need to almost manage your energies and manage your focus in a way that keeps the right level of momentum. Now, there isn't a formula for that, because different people can manage different things. And I think from my position, it's important to recognize that some people can't be broad and some people don't want to be deep. So it's more about really finding out how people work best. The other challenge from a commercial perspective is actually just the resource allocation across. Now everything is a separate business, right? So the dating site and Hopper and Waybook and also we have quite a lot of investments that we've accrued over the years as well. They're all separate entities, but they're all owned by Term Partners. And because the dating business is smaller than you know, all of the other businesses, every business that we've started has become bigger and bigger. You almost face the difficult challenge of how you continue to invest your resource, both your time, your energy, and your finance into the dating business, when actually it might seem on the face of it that you can just put more fuel on the fire on one of the other businesses. And that's a strategic difficulty that you kind of have to ask yourself all of the time. But what is wonderful about it, and what I would never, you know, one of the main benefits is that we all speak. So every business has its own individual kind of catch-ups, meetings, sprints, that sort of stuff. Mm. But we all then have, you know, a lunch call on a Wednesday and a download on a Friday, and these are like time zone adjusted. But it just means that actually the win from one business is genuinely celebrated across the whole group. And sometimes you can be doing something in a business that feels maybe a little bit monotonous, but you know that the purpose of doing that is because we're part of something really special, actually, and we're part of a team that is really passionate about building really valuable products to enable people to grow their businesses. And I think the more people working across broader things that have a level of connection actually enable us to to have more surface area for celebration and for fulfillment.
Wonderful. I think that's a great way to close out our podcast, because I know we're coming towards the end of our time together. So it's a topic that I could talk about a lot. I've fascinating journey that you've been on there, and that you're still on with Waybook. And actually, just as a final closing question for you to close out the episode, you talked about curiosity there. I know you're relatively early on in that journey with Waybook.com, but what kind of problems or businesses are you interested in, maybe in the back of your mind? What kind of pain points do you see for entrepreneurs or marketers that maybe you think need solving? Is there anything that you're working on behind the scenes at the moment, or is your focus very much still on Waybook.com and growing that?
My focus and energy is Waybook at the moment. That's where we're super, you know, that's where we see the future. That's where we're super excited. That's where we're seeing, you know, it's actually the first business where we've been working largely with the founders and CEOs of businesses. So, I mean, if you jump on a demo on Waybook, then you'll be given to one of the team. But I'm also on a lot of those calls just because I geek out on talking about people's businesses with people. So that's where a lot of my focus is. But I think the areas that I find interesting are this future of work. I think in the last 2 years, we've gone through the most fundamental shift of how we work, but crucially why we work and what we've had in the last 10. And you know, you see even bigger corporates that were resistant to change and embracing technology have had to take that on. We've seen displacements or people moving from cities to different areas. And I feel like this period of flux is only just beginning. So the future of work, but also the future of how work and life work together is really important. One area that we love a lot, and we've actually invested in quite a few businesses in the space, is in the mental health space within work. And that's something that we're really passionate about, because where everybody has their own mental health, in a workplace, you know, in an office, that you can construct at least a shared physical experience. Whereas when people are working from home or working remotely, it's extraordinarily difficult to really empathize on what your team and what your colleagues are going through when they're in just, you only see a little square around their head. So we're very interested and very excited into that space, and believe that there's a lot of opportunities, but also necessity for innovation within there. Anything to do with future of work, anything to do with future of living in different locations is what we're super excited about and seeing, you know, there's going to be big change.
Yeah. And there are so many parallels between the working future and your approach to work at a startup studio. Basically, you have the perfect environment to tap into this kind of fluid and iterative future, the way in which things are changing. So it's an exciting place to be you, I imagine. It's an exciting place to be at if you're at Term Partners. I wish you all the best with all of those businesses. Like I said, it's been a really interesting discussion. Before I let you go, though, do you want to let our listeners know where they can find out more about you and all of those businesses under the umbrella of Term Partners?
Absolutely, yeah. Thank you so much. Thanks for having me on. I mentioned halfway through, but you did an excellent job of keeping me to some sort of narrative, which is not always the easiest thing, I admit. So, I mentioned earlier, I geek out on talking to founders and talking to people about scaling their businesses or wherever they are. So I'd love people to get in touch. You can contact me on Twitter at Mike Bander. Also, I'm on LinkedIn probably more than anything else, and then you can find out about the businesses at either termpartners.com to kind of see a little bit about everything, or the real one is if you wanted to jump onto waybook.com. that's where all of the excitement's happening within, but particularly in my days at the moment, that's where you'll often find me on the calls and on the video comment there as well.
Wonderful. Listeners, links to everything that we've discussed today will be in the show notes. And for now, Mike, I'll say thank you very much for your time. This has been the Internet Marketing Podcast. Take care.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.